If there were an academic variant of Murphy's Law, it might go like this: when you are accepted at a conference at a European capital to speak about Carl Goldmark, you can expect three weeks later to browse the new acquisition shelf of the music library at the University of Toronto and find a book by David Brodbeck called Defining Deutschland, in which most of the points you wish to make about Carl Goldmark and several others besides are made as well as they can be made. Then you arrive, and you can expect no less a scholar than Richard Taruskin in the keynote address to deal incisively with the musical excerpts you had wished to focus on. I hope I have a few original things to add, perhaps informed by my status as a practical music critic, who allows his personal opinions to influence his premises and conclusions. So I give you fair warning: I think Deacon von Saba is a very good opera, and this opinion has most certainly infected my discourse. I also believe Goldmark has been done a disservice by the essentialist character of much comment on his most famous opera. I shall go so far as to suggest that the suppositions behind the old anti-Semitic attacks on Deaconic and von Saba are not entirely absent from sympathetic readings, although, of course, the former are infinitely more pernicious. Finally, I confess to a fondness for Carl Goldmark and a willingness to accept his testimony. I am aware that the memoirs, there's a copy over there, are not completely reliable on all details, but I think a composer who defines himself in the title of his autobiography as Viennese and takes pains to minimize any discussion of his otherness can be expected to have accomplished something similar in his music. So the opera, Königin von Saba, inspired by a compliment paid to Goldmark's teenage student, Carolina Bettelheim, whose name we have heard a few times. Look at that girl, that face, the very image of the Queen of Sheba. This is what the stage manager at the Hofoper is reported by her mother to have said. After this flash of lightning, the thought of the Queen of Sheba gave Goldmark no peace. And if we take him at his word, he created the book concerning a love triangle of which there is no trace in the Book of Kings. So this is not in any meaningful sense a scriptural opera or stage oratorio claim that could be made on behalf of Sanson et Dalila. Attempts to work up a libretto, there's a bit of a timeline, with an amateur poet came to nothing, and then the composer met by chance on the street, again as Goldmark reports, Solomon Heron Mosenthal, the busiest and most successful librettist in Vienna, the German Scribe, as some describe him. And to meet someone like that on the street in Vienna, somehow it seems like a typically Viennese story, the village of the million. This happened shortly after the Philharmonic had programmed the Sakuntala overture, so we can surmise that Mosenthal recognized Goldmark as a good prospect. Within a fortnight, he had produced two acts on which Goldmark set to work. As Professor Taruskin noted, Goldmark made amendments, and notably, Magische Töne, the tenor arietta that was destined to be the opera's most easily excerpted hit. This, to me, says something about the composer's keen theatrical instincts, honed by long years of service in the pit as a violinist. He knew an opera was better off with such a calling card. Then the record becomes somewhat muddled. From the memoirs, we understand that Act III was slower in arrival and much less impressive as a dramatic text. Mosenthal proposed an improbable happy ending in which the central figures of Solomon's court, including the king, seek out the exiled blasphemer Assad in the desert and confer on him the wedding he has renounced. Goldmark worked hard to wrest a better conclusion from Mosenthal and decided to add a fourth act in which Assad renounces the queen and dies in the arms of Suleiman, whose superior moral character he finally recognizes, which is to say that Assad finally rejects the temptations of the flesh a la Tannhäuser. Professor Brodbeck has recently proposed that this reworking of the fourth act came as late as December 1874, leaving open the intriguing possibility of the influence of Aida, which had been performed in Vienna. Yesterday, I asked Mr. Mikushi whether there was an earlier score with a happy ending, separate from the one we saw under the glass. He said he was aware of no such thing, but Goldmark had the Brahmsian habit of destroying earlier versions. But it is clear that, from his memoirs, that he intensely disliked the bourgeois Mosenthal ending. At any rate, Goldmark had a score of some kind presented to the Hofburg in 1871, before the premiere of Aida in Cairo. "Oh, time of bitter trouble," he writes in his memoirs. Johann Herbeck, director of the opera, was a staunch opponent. For it was Otto Dessauff, who was remembered as the de facto founder of the Vienna Philharmonic as a great orchestra, a friend of Brahms. But Dessauff was being maneuvered out of the opera at that time. There's no time to rehearse the many intrigues, but it appears that public pressure began to mount in the 1870s. And there was also an embarrassing dearth of Austrian music at the opera. So Herbeck gave in, and Goldmark tells us he actually started to like the music when he began rehearsing it. So despite last-minute cuts and an inauspicious dress rehearsal, the opera was given on March 10th, 75. Amalie Materna, Wagner's Brunhilde, the following year in Bayreuth, was in the title role, which calls for a mezzo-soprano with an extended on. The premiere falls, incidentally, by exactly a week, the opening in Paris of another opera that concerned the divided loyalties of a tenor who was betrothed to a woman of his hometown and social station, but obsessed with a sultry mezzo-soprano of exotic genesis, and speaking of Carmen, interesting coincidence. Sanson and Dalila performed 1877 in German at the behest of Liszt. So an interesting decade, the 1870s. The first performance was reviewed, and we shall discuss certain of these reviews presently. Regardless of critical reception, the opera was a hit. Goldmark reports with satisfaction that it was given 30 times to full houses during the first winter season. In 76, it was given in Budapest. Then, as now, a Goldmark redoubt and made the rounds of European cities, including some Italian stops, about which Goldmark has amusing things to say in his memoirs. And to fill up the discussion by Eva, here is the a quotation. This refers to a joke that Mosenthal played on him, I think in 72. He said, "Oh, Goldmark, have you heard? The opera has been accepted for next season. It's Aida." And Goldmark was a very gentle soul. He seemed to attract jibes and practical jokes. Well, not practical jokes, but jokes anyway. And so there you see the quotation from his notes, in which he feels that he was done out of the opportunity to present a new kind of opera to the Viennese public. And here we have, I've given you just a brief outline of where it went, made the rounds. 1885, Metropolitan Opera, where it received 15 performances more than any other opera, and was said by the New York Times to have been seen by upward of 40,000 persons. Although Wagner was surely the highest grossing composer of that season, with 35 performances of 5 operas, Rienzi among them. By 1889, the anonymous reviewer for the New York Times could say that the familiar work received a cordial welcome. The familiar work. It was a lavish performance that featured supernumeraries of more than one race and a property elephant. What that means, I presume that means a giant fixed elephant, not one in which there were stagehands making the elephant move like a pantomime horse. I'm not quite sure what the property horse elephant might look like. Perhaps it was recycled for Aida as well. That review, incidentally, includes not a word. It is not a single allusion to Goldmark's Jewish ancestry. We have heard already about success in Vienna. There was a new production in 1901, although unfortunately we cannot count Mahler among Goldmark's supporters. The Met mounted a new production in 1905, which went on tour, ending up in San Francisco on April 16, 1906. There was a little earthquake 2 days later, and the production was literally destroyed. The most unfortunate event. And as incidental evidence of its respectable status, I give you its presence in the story of 100 operas, of 100 operas. The author of this book, incidentally, his name is Felix Mendelssohn with one S. And as you'll see here, following Ikuratani, the Queen of Sheba, and Goldmark has been promoted to the nobility. That's Carl von Goldmark. Not entirely implausible, because Mosenthal was a Ritter, was created a Ritter, and so amusing as it seems now, it would not have been out of the question. Now, I need not elaborate why Die König und von Sabbe disappeared from the Central European repertoire in the 1930s, although it is interesting that the ballet music was performed by the Berlin Philharmonic as late as September 24, 1933. As for its fortunes across the Atlantic, leaving aside the catastrophe in San Francisco, I think it is fair to speculate that there might have been a perception that Aida and Die König und von Sabbe in the same or even alternating seasons would be too much of a big thing. And of course, room was being made for the new and invigorating operas of Puccini. So there's a short profile of the opera as an artifact of performance history. How to describe it as a musical score. We've already heard some of the music, which is helpful because time is limited. Now, I would like to play, however, if I could, the beginning of the overture, the very beginning of the overture. It shall be done. As I believe Professor Trust mentioned, we now hear solid music that reappears in the temple scene. this theme in the cellos, which we have called the Passion theme, is important. I'm not going to hear that again. So time again, the dream is impossible. Oh, here we go. We've already made a jump. Just one note that we've gone from C to G flat here, fairly adventuresome, and I think that despite the interview that interval that draws attention to itself, that this is a wonderful overture. It's a storytelling Wagnerian overture, not a popery overture. And it could be revived, I think, as a concert piece very effectively. And I would say, in my view, not heard as a label, not heard as something with oriental content, it would be heard as a labelmatic work. Now, we arrive at the arrival of Queen Sheba in Act One, where the oriental blood test does produce positive results and around immediately. We've already heard this music. The Prophet, I would think it could be the Wartburg, it could be Brabant. And we'll not play that again. We practically know it by heart. And this is the point after the ceremonial march. The Ram's Horn. This is that while it's augmented second and its layout character is indisputable, but must not be forgotten that this is the tune that this tune is an orientalized version of the passion motif we heard in the overture, and which loomed large in Assad's Act One narrative, in which he pours out his heart to Solomon, who wisely counsels him to think of Jehovah, and the name is pronounced Jehovah. Goldmark thus both links and distances the central characters to the deployment of this motif, and perhaps hints at the impossibility of the liaison. Of course, the queen has to be other, and this otherness must be communicated musically, but she can be other only if the court of Solomon constitutes a familiar environment in which her otherness is apparent, an environment that I maintain feels like romantic European and often Wagnerian home turf. Now, with time, I could give you the fantastic Schiergarten, where the queen retreats to get away from the party. It's the influence of Mendelssohn is unmistakable here in Summer Night's Dream. Then the queen requires her slave, Astaroth, to sing a song of seduction. And we've already heard this, so I'm not going to play it again. There are some conventional and unconventional intervals here. And it's a fairly short sequence, but of course, it's very effective. Goldmark's memoirs comments that in Turin, a couple of old gentlemen in the front rows thought that these intervals were mistakes. That they were mistakes by the singers, which I guess is meaningful for a listener at the time to tell you how this came across. However, what happens immediately is we have this beautiful Ariadne, Magna Chatona, which reminds me a little bit of Celeste Aida, the conductor in Bologna, and referred to it as a Bellini aria, but with the gentle six-state time and the upward reach, there is a likeness there. But what I want to point out is that it immediately answers the Orientalism of Astaroth's vocalese. I won't say it neutralizes it, or maybe I will. So we're brought back very swiftly into the familiar territory that the audience would recognize as musically their own. So I'm not giving you our vast swaths of Wagnerian narrative without a trace of Orientalism, although these exist. I'm not giving you a Suleiman's solo of Act 3 in which he pleads to Solomon to show mercy on Assad with a very close pass to the Liebesode. But I thought it was important to illustrate what I hear happening in the Königin von Saba. Oriental touches are applied sparingly and with complete dramatic propriety to an otherwise warmly Western fabric that is informed substantially by the example of Wagner and notable for its lack of Oriental signification. Now, this is not how our friend Edward Hanslick perceived the opera in his review of the first performance, where we learn that Astaroth's vocalese is music with which one may push pious Jews into a synagogue, but no lover to a rendezvous. Ludwig Spiedel, a critic who had already detected strongly hooked noses and sidewalks in Goldmark's Sekunto overture, devotes much space to demolishing the libretto, but also has harsh words for the melodic phrases in which, quote, something nervous and obscurely sentimental can be heard whining and moaning. These are the tones of the ethos of a people that has had to endure many painful things from its God and the rest of the world. And again, it is not overlooked that Goldmark, quote, is, after all, an Israelite from Hungary. Professor Broadbeck has pointed out that these reviews of the 1870s, as hard as they are to stomach today, are Valentines compared to some of the diatribes that later emerged from the Viennese press when anti-Semitism fueled by Wagner's writings and Karl Weber's politics developed a more explicitly racialist character. I've given you a few other choice bits to reflect on. But if we turn to the voluminous review of Henry Crebel, or Crebel, of the New York premiere, we get a more balanced assessment. He starts with days of discourse on the state of German opera, implying that what we are about to get is a report on one of these. Orientalism is not overlooked. Many other composers before him have made use of Oriental cadences and rhythms, but to none have they seemed to come so like a native language as to Goldmark, he comments, in the context of a huge review But Krehbiel lays more stress on the Wagnerian foundation of the story and score. Suleiman is Elizabeth, the queen is Venus, Assad is Tannhäuser, Solomon is Wolfram. That's laying it on the line. back on the continent, the notion that Goldmark had given vent to the music of his childhood proved remarkably resilient. Hanslick, in his review of Goldmark's 1886 opera, Merlin, "With sincere pleasure, I miss in Merlin a distinctive trait of the Kunigan von Saba, the Jewish Oriental melodies and sickly moaning spoil for us the undeniable beauties of the opera." Hanslick again seizes this occasion quite gratuitously to remind us that Goldmark grew up under a doubly Oriental influence, the Jewish and the Hungarian. And it was possible for this logic to prevail in more positive appreciations. Theodor Helm, in his review in the Deutsche Zeitung, took care to reverse the dogma that in the case of the Die Königin von Saba, we get the impression that Goldmark had to write the work, and he composed it from within, from personal experience, from the national religious memories of his youth. Which now brings us to the curious case of the critic Max Graf, who asserted confidently in his Legend of a Musical City, a collection of essays on the subject of Vienna, published in, I've just been told I have 20 more minutes. Max Graf, a supporter and friend of Sigmund Freud, who was quite prepared to believe that such expression could manifest itself, unconsciously professes great affection for the composer, sees him as a wise old rabbi, takes care to explain that Goldmark was born in Hungary, which of all European cities is nearest the Orient, a motif we've heard repeatedly. As for Goldmark, he was the most perfect representative of the Jewish personality that Graf had ever met, excepting Freud, Einstein, and the chief rabbi of Austria. We have this report that rabbi said that Goldmark did not have to go to the Orient. The Orient was in his soul. And he said this at his tomb. We cannot know if the composer rolled in his grave, but we know from Graf that Goldmark was made furious by this notion that he had created the Jewish National Opera. And at this point, I guess I have to conclude. We have here Goldmark on Orientalism. And I guess the only point I want to make about this, and Professor Truskin's already discussed this, is that Solon is not quite as strong as each one must be different. At this point, he's reflecting in his memoirs on the procedure he thought he had to go through when he wrote the opera itself. And I submit that what he ended up doing was adding Oriental elements very judiciously. And when I saw the performance at the Airco Theater 4 weeks ago, I felt quite confirmed in this feeling that the home turf is essentially Western and not Oriental. So I've given you a bit of a negative result, but I think it's one that bears thinking about. It could be that my perception is lacking. I've heard so many performances of Debussy by the Montreal Symphony that the harp might not register as surely as an exotic instrument as it does to the people at the time. But I think on balance, this is the way to hear the Kunigan. And finally, I just have some popular sources here. This is the final line in the New Grove Dictionary of Opera. The opera may well have been influenced by the ideas of the great Viennese cantor Salomon Sulzer, who was concerned to restore Jewish music to its Oriental origins. A completely speculative idea. I don't think there's any. I've not found any documentation to support that. And then the Hungarian Wikipedia, which is an excellent entry, very thorough. Again, we have. Also important is the composer's employment of the melody of melodic treasures from Eastern Jewish liturgy, the attraction of Eastern motives is incisive in both parts of it. So So those are my observations. I guess just the final editorial note, if you want to put this opera back into the repertoire, I'd be willing to call it the National Opera of Estonia, if it could actually be performed more often. There's one recording, it's out of print from 1980. My experience, as I say a few weeks ago at the Airport Theater, left me with no doubt that it's a hit, that piece of you about it. Thank you.